The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So this evening, we are on the second week of this three-week series on balanced practice, and if you didn't come to the first one, that's no problem. We've been talking about examples from the suttas that help us see that the path that the Buddha taught and the teachings that he gave are kind of multifaceted and nuanced in certain ways. We're not just given formulaic things or only one way to see things. And, you know, there's different ways of interpreting this. You could say, well, it was all just put together by a lot of different people and, you know, it's an accident of history and they didn't check it carefully. But I prefer to think that this path has to accommodate many different kinds of mind. And so the Buddha gave a lot of different kinds of teaching. And it's part of our job as practitioners now, reading these words that are left, is that we have to kind of navigate that for ourselves and understand, oh, there's aspects of practice that need to be balanced, and, you know, not to get too wrapped up in it. Truthfully, your rational mind is not the best guide for your path, as you'll learn over time. But it's helpful to be aware of these different dimensions that the Buddha taught. So last time we talked about approaching the teachings with an attitude of sort of faith or surrender or openness and just following the instructions, and then comparing that to a sort of an inquiry-based mode of practice and one that really uses investigation and digs in and checks things. And those two are both there in the teachings, and so we navigate that in our own practice. And tonight we're going to talk about the balance of cultivation and letting go, which are also two different dimensions that are both rather strongly emphasized, both of them, in the text. Very interesting. So I want to start, actually, with a story. So imagine that there are three Dharma students and a teacher, and one student says to the teacher, "You have said that the path is like climbing a great mountain, requiring a lot of strength and diligence and effort." And the teacher says, "You are correct." And then the second student says, "Wait a minute. You also said that the path is like rolling down a hill or just flowing down a river. It should be completely effortless, just letting go into the stream of the Dharma." And the teacher says, "Oh, you are correct." And the third student says, "Well, they can't both be correct." And the teacher says, "And you are also correct." Yeah? So this is what we're gonna look at today. What's going on here? So the dimensions of cultivation and letting go. There's no shortage of suttas about making effort and cultivating good qualities and developing persistence and diligence and keenness of mind. Really, you know all those lists that are in the texts, and even if you don't, there are a lot of lists in the texts. And somebody counted up the occurrence of different factors on all the lists. I don't know if they got all the lists, but according to a count of the common lists at least, energy or effort, which is virya in Pali, is the quality that appears in the most lists. So it's definitely emphasized. You cannot accurately say that it was not emphasized in the texts. Now, interestingly, energy for practice is supported by faith or by this quality of trust or confidence, either in the teacher or in the teachings. This is made explicit in a list called the Five Faculties, which begins with faith, and then there's energy, and then mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. But faith is like this support for having energy, essentially. And It kind of makes sense. I mean, you don't need to know that list of the five faculties to understand that when you have confidence, only when you have confidence in something are you going to put out the energy, invest some energy in it. And on the flip side, if you have confidence in something, you would want to, you would delight in putting effort into it. You would say, yes, this is what I want to do. I'm going to go with this. So one word that's used frequently for this kind of effort or for making effort is usually translated into English as strive. And we'll be talking about, you know, we'll be talking a little bit more about this, but let me just offer some quotes. So here's one. Out of regard for your own good, it is proper to strive with heedfulness. Out of regard for others' good, it is proper to strive with heedfulness. Out of regard for your own and others' good, it is proper to strive with heedfulness. So it tells you very clearly this is what to do. Sariputta's last words were strive on with heedfulness. Very similar to the Buddha's, which are sometimes translated as work out your deliverance with heedfulness or some such. They're very similar. But essentially, the instruction is carry on. But it's interesting that in these quotes and others, and I picked these for a reason, it says that one should strive with heedfulness. So we're not just sort of rampantly striving. There's this sense of, you know, what does heedfulness mean? You know, awareness of what you're striving for and why, some wisdom behind our effort, essentially. So right here we have the faith and the wisdom, also related to investigation. We have that balance being preserved right there in right effort. That's what we talked about last week, is the faith and the wisdom, the faith and the investigation. Now, we're not just making effort because someone told us to or because we have some abstract ideal that that's what we're supposed to do. Here's a nice quote from a book called The Questions of King Melinda. When the practitioner sees that the hearts of others have been set free, he leaps forward by way of aspiration to the various fruits of the holy life, and he makes efforts to attain the yet unattained, to find the yet unfound, to realize the yet unrealized. So I think this is quite beautiful. It's that we see that the hearts of others have been set free, and so we leap forward. It doesn't mean necessarily that we know arahants are completely free people. We just know that there are people who have something. They've got something, right? Something has worked out for them. I know that when I was just starting to sit with a group, I sat on my own for a little while, and then at some point it occurred to me that other people might do this too, and I could find them. And I came to a meditation group, and I was struck by just the senior students in the group. It was led by a teacher, but kind of a peer teacher. And I just felt like the senior students in that group were very comfortable with themselves. That was the quality I noticed in them. Probably because at that time in my life, I wasn't that comfortable with myself yet. And so I was, you know, that sort of really struck me. And they weren't arrogant or proud or, you know, cliquish or something. It was just, they just felt very comfortable with themselves. They were fine with how they were. And I thought, if that's what this practice does, okay, I'm in, you know. This was a very early kind of aspiration for me. Later my aspirations changed, but that was the initial attraction for me, was seeing that others, something had happened to others, clearly, such that they had this comfort with themselves. Okay, so we understand that there's a lot of encouragement to make effort. In what areas are we to make effort? There are two main ones, I would say. The first is ethical effort. So effort to keep the precepts, to remain truthful, to be generous. There's a lot of diligence needed as we all know from our lay lives, we're constantly confronted with situations where there's an ethical choice. You know, do I respond with love or with selfishness? Do I let go and give in this situation, or do I close and I'm not able to do that? Or, you know, do I stretch the truth a little bit, exaggerate a little bit to make myself look good, or do I stick very carefully to exactly what I know and what I think is true? And, you know, when they're framed this way, I've made it kind of clear which one was preferable. But there's a lot of gray areas, too, in our lay life where it's not totally obvious. And there may not be one abstract, absolute answer. It may really be that there are different answers for different people in certain situations. And so there's a lot of effort, I think, involved in becoming comfortable with ourselves, because we know that we've behaved ethically and that we're acting in line with our heart's values. There's a lot about this in the suttas. So Buddha knew this was a big deal for both monks and for lay people, actually. So this kind of effort purifies our actions and our speech and even some of our main ways of thinking that we have as habit. Just the effort to keep the precepts and be virtuous and be generous can do a lot for our practice. We're going to talk a little bit more on ethical practice next week. But it's interesting that that's not the only effort. That's not the aim. It's not the final. There is also a lot of effort in developing qualities of the mind, and not just purity and ethical qualities of the mind, but things like our capacity for attention, our ability to concentrate the mind, and insight, and the ability to have insights. This is also an area that requires specific kind of effort, particularly effort in meditation, actually. And the Buddha was very clear that this is needed. There has to be something beyond creation of good karma, essentially. There's this other kind of effort. And it's said that this kind of effort, the effort to really develop these deeper qualities of the mind, is what purifies our intentions, what are called the underlying tendencies in our mind. So just to make an analogy, if we've gotten to the point where we're already making an action of lying or stealing, and we stop ourselves from that, yes, we've made a good effort to be ethical and create good karma there. But it's not quite enough to purify the tendency of the mind to want to do that. And it's a subtle difference. So, and we can be very, very good at restraining ourselves and get to the point where, you know, we're not going to do anything blatantly unwholesome in the world. But there's still that tendency. We may still think of it, or we may still incline towards it. And that's a little bit of suffering in the mind. If the heart still has that ability to see, oh, I could pick that up off the table, you know. Maybe I'm giving a gross example, but, you know, just that that tendency toward, it starts to abrade in the mind eventually. And so then there's this need for meditation to really get down and get to the mind to the point where it's not even going to intend any harm. That would be freer. That would be less suffering for our own heart if we didn't even have that intention, whether or not we act on it. So that, you know, that's this other kind of effort, and that is what eventually frees the mind. So those are the two main areas. I'll add that for monastics, there is also in the suttas instruction about making effort to uphold the monastic rules and discipline. So that's maybe a slightly different kind of effort, and that's one that lay people don't participate in directly. Okay, so here is a standard way of talking about how we should make effort. Language. One should arouse extraordinary desire, make an extraordinary effort, stir up zeal and enthusiasm, be unremitting, and exercise mindfulness and clear comprehension. Whew. It's like, I feel exhausted just mm-hmm. listening to that. But this is, you know, this is how important the Buddha thought this was. Okay, so now I want to talk about a specific sutta where, maybe I'll even open it up since I have the book here. So this is a sutta about making effort, actually. And it's about the question of whether or not completely, you know, what does it mean to have completely wholesome behavior, to, you know, to have that effort be fully accomplished. And another teacher, so someone who's not a Buddhist, one of the other wanderers, declares that basically he declares that a person who is accomplished in what is wholesome consists of doing no evil actions, no evil speech, no evil intentions, and no evil livelihood. So if those four things are accomplished in a person, then they can be said to be accomplished in what is wholesome. And at the surface level, you might say, yeah, okay, you know, you don't do anything with body, speech, or even mind. That must be the full accomplishment of what is wholesome. Believe it or not, the Buddha disagrees with this. And he says, let me quote here. If that were so, then a young, tender infant lying prone is accomplished in what is wholesome, perfected in what is wholesome, an ascetic, invincible, attained to the supreme attainment. Why? Because for a young, tender infant lying prone, he does not even have the notion of body, so how could he do an evil bodily action beyond mere wriggling? A young, tender infant lying prone does not even have the notion of speech, so how should he utter evil speech beyond mere whining? A young, tender infant lying prone does not even have the notion of intention, so how should he have evil intentions beyond mere sulking? And a young, tender infant lying prone does not even have the notion of livelihood, so how should he make his living by evil livelihood beyond being suckled at his mother's breast? So he turns the logic around and he says, you know, that is not, you know, just this pure, this sort of total purity of action is not the aim. So that's not what all the effort is aiming at. Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. So he goes on to say, but he does go on to say that a person who wants to develop this, wants to develop, become fully accomplished in what is wholesome, he must exert a lot of effort. And what does that consist of? So it consists of, first there's a change in understanding, and the person understands which habits of his mind are wholesome and which are unwholesome. So he's still along these lines. He's discerning which they are. And then he has to understand basically where good and bad, if you will, or wholesome and unwholesome, kusala and akusala, intentions and actions originate in the mind. So he applies sort of the Four Noble Truths mm-hmm. to the appearance of unwholesome and then later wholesome actions, thoughts in the mind. So he says, it must be understood thus. These are unwholesome habits. Unwholesome habits originate from this. Unwholesome habits cease without remainder here. And one practicing in this way is practicing the way to the cessation of unwholesome habits. So he's supposed to first change his understanding to understanding action in terms of the Four Noble Truths. Where does it come from? Where does it cease? How does one practice so that the unwholesome habits cease? And then interestingly, he suggests that we should practice such that the wholesome habits cease too. We'll get back to that later. I want to talk about that in the next section. But the point here is that he's not pointing towards some kind of unthinking purity like that of a child. Sometimes people say on this path even, oh, I wish my mind, you know, I look at my children and their minds are so innocent, or animals, they're so innocent, you know, but it's only our complicated adult minds that think about livelihood, that think about this and that. That's where the problem comes. If we could just, you know, get back to our earlier innocent purity, that would be more like enlightenment. And the Buddha is saying, no, that's not true, which I think provides great hope for us, because we're not going back to that, are we? You know, we live in this world. We do. And so he says there's another kind of effort to be made. First, he says the effort is to switch the way we see things in terms of the Four Noble Truths. And then I won't go on in this sutta, but he says to practice the Eightfold Path. So the effort is the effort of right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. Okay, so I do want to pick up one point about this that we just heard in this sutta, and which is true in other ones, which is that often in the case of right effort and choosing what to do, the Buddha is very almost black and white. Like, he talks about wholesome and unwholesome. He talks about kusala and akusala. Those are often the words, or other words that are sort of dichotomies. Sometimes he'll say bright and dark, righteous and unrighteous, these kinds of words. And basically he says everything can be divided. You know, I divided my thoughts into two types, wholesome and unwholesome. Or you can do actions that are righteous or actions that are unrighteous, and make sure that you know. It sounds, whenever I read suttas that are particularly about effort, they sound dualistic to me. And I don't, you know, I don't have a clear scholarly answer to that, but Gill suggests that maybe this is just out of pragmatism. Gill has noticed this too. And that the Buddha teaches simply what works and what doesn't work. And so he's, you know, that's why he ends up being a little bit dualistic. I think it's interesting, you know, pulling back and looking at our modern, you know, how we teach the Dharma, it's interesting that this strong emphasis on effort is really, it's really all over the suttas. You can't say it's not there. But we de-emphasize it somewhat, I've noticed, in our teachings here in the West, like at Spirit Rock. And I don't know, these days Gil has been talking a lot about joy and ease and happiness, which is lovely. which is lovely. We'll get to that in the next section of this, of tonight. But my sense is that people here in the Bay Area might already be strivers to some degree. We're so active and so agitated in the way that we live. I mean, really, life here is very fast-paced and stressful, really. And we may benefit more from teachings about relaxing and easing up and softening and slowing down. So it may be that just out of, again, out of pragmatism, those are the teachings that get emphasized here right from the beginning. You know, there's this sense of stop. You've got to stop all that momentum. But I can say that this isn't unique to the West. There is a sutta where this happens to a monk, actually. There's a monk named Sona, and I really like Sona. I don't know why. It's just, you know, certain people in the suttas kind of reach out to you. So this poor guy, Sona, was kind of a soft guy out in the world. Like, he was kind of pampered, rich from a wealthy family, I think, and had led a pretty protected life. But he gets inspired and he ordains, and he gets really into it. And he does walking meditation, and he just walks and walks and walks because he's so determined. And his feet start bleeding. You know, they split open and his feet are a mess. And he's still not enlightened. And he gets discouraged. His feet hurt. And he thought he was doing the practice as diligently as the Buddha had been saying. And so he has this thought, why don't I give up? Why don't I you know, disrobe, go back to the household life. Probably that my parami aren't very good. No, he didn't say that in the sutta, but he said, go back to the household life, enjoy sensual pleasures and make merit. So, you know, that means, you know, go back to my good life and do good deeds. Mm-hmm. And that's good, you know, be ethical. And the Buddha, in his with his powerful mind, hears Sona's thought and comes and says and stands before him, and he says, and he sort of plays back to Sona's earlier life, and he says, "What do you think, Sona? Before, when you were a house dweller, were you skilled at playing the veena, which is a stringed instrument?" And he says, "Yes, Lord." And the Buddha says, "And what do you think? When the strings of your veena were too taut, was your veena in tune and playable? No, Lord. And what do you think? When the strings of your veena were too loose, was your veena in tune and playable? No, Lord. And what do you think? When the strings of your veena were neither too taut nor too loose, but tuned to be right on pitch, was your veena in tune and playable? Yes, Lord." And so he says, in the same way, Sona, over-aroused persistence leads to restlessness. Overly slack persistence leads to laziness. Thus, you should determine the right pitch for your persistence, attune the pitch of the five faculties to that, remember the five faculties from earlier, and there pick up your theme. I use Tanjev's translation. And so basically he says, you got to balance. You know, you can't walk until your feet bleed, but neither can you just lie around. You've got to, you do have to do some effort. And Sona does this and becomes an arahant. So maybe I won't actually read from it. So there's this sense of, you know, of the effort being necessary, but you have to make effort in the right way. So strive with heedfulness. And it's not heedful to strive until your feet bleed sometimes. Sometimes it is. So let's pause there for a moment, actually, and let me ask, you know, how is this striking you? What do you think about effort? Have there been things on your path that really needed to be cultivated and you had to work at it? Does that sound familiar? Or any comments on the or questions about the suttas that we've read so far?
Trying to figure out when the effort is the right thing to do and the letting it be and letting it kind of percolate, I guess.
Yeah, so that's the wisdom.
To let the seed grow. Right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes you feel like you're making progress on whatever it is that you're putting the effort into. And you start to see whatever, for your own mind, you see a plateau. Mm-hmm. And there's two choices, I guess. There's continued effort and making your feet bleed at that point to get a modicum of return. And then there's choosing either a different way or not.
Yeah.
And still seeing some benefit of having rested or having let go. Maybe not resting is not the right word, no longer the same degree of effort.
Yeah.
But it never seems like there's a unique answer for all situations.
Yeah, I'm glad you didn't say, can you just tell me when to do it? Because you're right, you've answered your own question. There isn't a unique answer. I can offer from my own path that it's not perfect because my wisdom isn't perfect. And so I don't always, you know, I can't always know when to make effort or how to make effort. But often it can help to feel in the body. For me, you know, being in tune with the body and just feel like, are things, you know, opening or are things emerging somehow? Is there a sense in the body of ease? And I don't mean ease like everything's going easily. This is a little bit hard to describe, but there can be times when everything is, you know, happening in my mind, but there's something in my heart that's at ease. And so then I know, okay, this is supposed to be unfolding. This is the way it is. But there are times when it feels like the energy is getting stuck, or my, you know, even though I'm making effort or doing something on my path, there's something in my heart that's saying, there isn't a lot of joy there, a lot of ease, or, yeah. Not that there always needs to be joy, and not that there even always needs to be ease. You can make a religion out of, you know, any of these things and say this is how it always has to be. But there's something about, yeah, feeling if the mindfulness can continue, if the path, I think as long as we're able to be aware of what's happening, whether it's, you know, pleasant or unpleasant, essentially, if the awareness can stay with it, then the path is unfolding. I think that's my sense. Like, I'll give an example, is that an instruction I've often heard on retreat, which I use, is when there's walking meditation, people often ask, well, how fast should I walk? Mm-hmm. You know, should I walk really, really slowly and try to look super mindful? Well, I don't know. You know, maybe what the instruction I've heard is that you walk at the pace such that you can be maximally mindful. I thought that's really brilliant, actually. And, you know, it's the correct pace is the one where you can stay paying attention. And if you're going too slow and your mind is wandering off, pick up the pace a little bit to keep the mind engaged. If you're going really quickly but the mind is getting agitated from that, slow down so that the mind can stay with what's happening. Yeah. Maybe the best response I can give for now. Other comments or questions?
So, Gil mentioned something about this on Sunday, actually, and I don't remember the context.
Uh-huh.
I think maybe it was during a question or something, but he said that effort should never feel like you're climbing uphill.
Yeah, and that's probably what I was referring to.
There should
always
be some ease, so...
Yeah, this inner ease, I think, does need to be there.
But then it was interesting, that first sutta that you read, he does make an analogy to climbing uphill.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so that was actually in the story that I read.
The story,
the story,
right,
that I told,
right,
which is, yeah, it wasn't from the suttas, actually.
Okay, okay.
Maybe I should have been clear about that.
No.
In a sutta class.
No, but yeah, and that just maybe that it can, it's still an analogy, but it shouldn't feel like that I think Gil was kind of just saying, like, it shouldn't feel like that striving or really difficult, like, endless climb up a mountain.
Yeah, I think if it feels like it's endless, that's right, probably not. If you're getting discouraged and burdened and dragged down, that's a sign that, you know, maybe it's the wrong kind of effort.
Yeah, so maybe that's what he meant.
Maybe.
I don't remember the context.
I don't know. I think, I'm sure he could describe it better. My experience is that the path goes up and down hills.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we approach the uphill in various ways. Probably, you know, rushing to get there as fast as you can and striving, maybe not. Or maybe we need to do that for a while to learn that that's uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there are ways to climb uphill and still be at ease doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So that may be a way to unite those two.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, sometimes the path delivers us really challenging stuff. Even if you're floating down a river, which I think he talked about on Sunday,
yeah,
you may go through the rapids, you may go over a waterfall,
mm-hmm,
you know. You may reach a shallow place and you're bumping against the rocks on the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think the effort is to be with what's happening,
mm-hmm,
yeah, in an open, loving way. And maybe that's where the ease comes in.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so can we move on and talk a little bit about the letting go? Okay, great. So we've talked about the striving and the effort, and there is a lot of that, and it's not only that. There's a lot also about letting go and about opening and about being at ease, and particularly the instructions for the later stages of concentration and insight practice are characterized by letting go and letting be. And this is also called abandoning, disenchantment, dispassion. You know, the mind becomes equanimous and still. You know, images like this. There's a story about Ananda in the suttas where this was after the Buddha died, and there was a council of all the arhats getting together to basically recite all the teachings and make sure that the body of teachings that he taught was kind of unified and remembered. You can imagine that was a big task after the Buddha died, to kind of, what are we going to do now? Gather all this together, and you know, we have the fruits of it in these books, some version of the fruit. I don't know how it came down to us, but there was apparently a council after the Buddha died. And Ananda, as you may know about him, was his attendant and had a fantastic memory and was there at many of his teachings and had them all memorized, essentially. And so the idea was that, you know, maybe he could come and recite them. But the arhats said, well, Ananda's not an arahant, because he wasn't yet. He had attained the first stage of enlightenment, at least. So he was no longer a worldling, but he wasn't fully enlightened like the arahants. And so they said, I don't think he can come. He's not, he's not completely wise yet. And so they told him this, and they said, you know, sorry, you know, we'd really like to have you, but only arahants can come. And so Ananda got motivated, and he sat up that night, and he practiced, and he practiced, and he tried really hard. He did all of the practices that the Buddha had told him. I'm sure he was a good practitioner, but near dawn, he just got tired, and he wasn't an arahant yet, and he gave up. And it said that he was going to bed, and he was just leaning over. He was actually just before his head hit the pillow, he got enlightened. He's the only person described in the suttas to be enlightened not in one of the four positions of sitting, standing, walking, or lying down. He was in between. So it's interesting. I don't know if the story's true or not, but I think it points toward, and you see this again and again in subtle ways, is in various iterations in the suttas, is that you try and try and try, and then when you give up, something can happen. But it wouldn't have happened without the trying, right? He probably, if Ananda had just gone to bed, he might not have become the arahant. So maybe this is another answer to the mountain question, is you have to try to climb the mountain, but other things happen when you give up. So it's interesting, right? And then there's also an interesting conversation between Sariputta and Anuruddha. Sariputta was the Buddha's main kind of number one disciple, if you will, foremost in wisdom, said to be. And Anuruddha also became an arahant, but in this conversation, he was not an arahant yet. And so Anuruddha comes to Sariputta and he complains, basically, that although he has supernormal powers and unremitting energy, mindfulness, and concentration, still he is not liberated. So he comes and he says, I've got all this great stuff and I'm a fantastic practitioner, but still my mind is not free. And Sariputta says, friend, when you think energy is aroused in me without slackening, my mindfulness is established without confusion, my body is tranquil without disturbance, my mind is concentrated and one-pointed, this is your restlessness. Isn't that interesting? So, and then he criticizes other parts as being related to conceit and other things. I picked out the part where he talks about having great energy and mindfulness and concentration and all these powerful mental qualities which we're supposed to develop. And Sariputta dismisses them and says, this is restlessness. So, well, how can it be that we're supposed to develop energy and strive and apply? You know, if we don't do that, it's not going to happen. Nothing's going to happen in our life. But essentially what this says is, at some point, you don't need more of that. This is my interpretation. At some point, you don't need more of that. At some point, arousing energy, developing concentration, actually agitates the mind. And there's a little bit of restlessness there from all of that. And also thinking, I have this, my mind is doing this. This is also an agitating thought. So he's talking about something very wholesome, something very good. I mean, he'd probably achieved high levels of jhana in order to have supernormal powers. So this is like really accomplished in meditation. And yet, at some point, this is about restlessness. Restlessness, by the way, is one of the very last fetters in the mind to go before one can become completely free. A lot of the other hindrances go earlier. Doubt is gone at stream entry. Desire and aversion are gone by non-returning. But restlessness persists all the way until arhatship. And it's this subtle restlessness of knowing that you're a good meditator, of, you know, getting up into high concentration states and maintaining them. This eventually starts to be a little bit agitating. Very interesting. So Sariputta's advice, after he names this restlessness to Anuruddha, is that he suggests to Anuruddha that he turn his mind toward the deathless. So he says, stop going into concentration states and focus instead on freeing your mind. You know, turn your mind toward opening it to freedom. And as these things go, he does that and becomes an arahant. But I think it's interesting that the message, what I'm pulling out of this as the message, is you do climb the mountain and do the effort, and then at some point you have to let go. You have to stop. Or, you know, like on riding a bike, you don't just pedal and pedal and pedal and pedal and pedal. At some point you get to stop and coast. You know, that's how you ride correctly. Or riding a skateboard, you don't just, you know, put your foot down, boom, zoom, 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 zoom. You put your foot down for a while and push, and then you coast for a little while, and then when you slow down, you do it again. Yeah? So this is okay, so now I'm going to return to something I mentioned earlier, which was the abandonment of wholesome states of mind, right? So here we have a very wholesome state of mind, and essentially Sariputta says you need to abandon this. Not abandon like throw it out, go turn on the music and party, you know, forget about concentration, but let it go, you know, stop pushing on it and just open the hand and let what's going to come, come. So, and in this sutta that I read from before about the young, tender infant lying prone, not really being fully accomplished in wholesome states, it says later that one should practice for the cessation of wholesome intentions. Why would the Buddha say that we should practice for the cessation of wholesome intentions? Now, it's not stated directly in the sutta, but a later part of the text implies that what this phrase means is that we don't identify with wholesome actions and mind states. So essentially, we should put effort into making ourselves wholesome and making our actions wholesome, but then we don't turn around and say, I am wholesome. So, yeah. Yeah, so we don't say, oh, I'm the one who's very good. So in particular, the sutta says, a practitioner is virtuous, but he's not identify with his virtue. And so this is essentially what he means by the cessation of the wholesome, is that we no longer think of ourselves as a generous person, as an honest person. This is like Anuruddha saying, I'm a great meditator, I have well-established mindfulness, I have all the jhanas, I have the supernormal powers. And Sariputta says that's the problem, is that you think you have all these things, and you have to get out of the way. Have you heard this phrase before? We need to get out of our own way. And this is often, so often true. So when the mind is getting close to liberation, even wholesome states have to be let go as states that we possess and cherish. So we see that even wholesomeness is not self, essentially. So the aim is not that we attain pure wholesomeness and stay there as a fixed identity. It's more subtle than that. And that's why we need both this effort and this letting go. There's also a very lovely sutta that has an extended simile of seeking heartwood. I think I'll open this one up too, just to, in case I need to quote something. So this is the greater discourse on the simile of the heartwood. And basically, it says, it analogizes a person going forth onto the path of practice. And it doesn't have to be, it talks about a monk, of course, but it doesn't have to be a monk. It could be any of us embarking on a path of meditation practice. It compares that to a person who is looking for heartwood. And the heartwood is the, you know, the very inner wood of the tree. And, you know, it's in the very center. It's the best and the highest quality of wood. And as you can imagine, it stands for the best and highest spiritual attainment. So it's, you know, what we're aiming for on the path. So to get to the heartwood, though, okay, so here, suppose a man needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, came to a great tree standing possessed of heartwood. Passing over its heartwood, its sapwood, its inner bark, and its outer bark, he would cut off its twigs and leaves and take them away, thinking they were heartwood. So this is like a mistake that we made. He's talking about what not to do in practice. And so essentially he says that the twigs and leaves are the equivalent of gain and praise. So basically, you know, maybe if you ordain, let's say you're in ancient India and you go and ordain, and so because you've done that, your family gets some honor and you are told, oh, how virtuous of you, that's great. And so you gain a little bit of status, essentially, by having embarked on this path. And basically he says, you missed the point if you're enjoying that. So he says, forget that. Forget the gain and the praise. And then, you know, the person goes on, and he's already set up the analogy by this passing over the heartwood, sapwood, inner bark, and outer bark, cut off the twigs and leaves. There are steps for each of those where he misses the heartwood but gets to the outer bark, and then he misses the heartwood but gets to the inner bark, and so forth. And these represent virtue, essentially. So we have gain and praise, virtue, concentration, and insight, interestingly. So he says that we should, in this analogy, if you want to get to the heartwood, yeah, you'll go through the twigs and leaves, you'll go through the outer bark, the inner bark, and the sapwood, but you don't stay there. You don't stop with that. So you don't stop with virtue. You have to go on. You don't stop with concentration. You get to that. It's very nice. In fact, it even says in here that he enjoys that, or he feels what does it say about it? He is pleased with that attainment. It says he's pleased with that attainment, but he does not, his intention is not fulfilled. He doesn't laud himself about it and disparage others and become identified with it. So gain and praise, virtue, concentration, and even insight, which I think is so interesting. So even having insights along the path, which we can get attached to, you know, we can have some kind of an opening on a retreat or even just in our daily life practice, suddenly something falls away, we have a big insight about our life or about the path, and then we get stuck on that. And we say, now I've got it. Now I understand. And what I love about this sutta is that he talks about both attainment and letting go. So he says, yes, attain these things. He says, you know, be pleased with that attainment. Be pleased with the attainment of virtue. Be pleased with the attainment of concentration. And it's not the heartwood. Keep going, keep going. And eventually he says that when a person gets to the heartwood, what they attain is perpetual deliverance, which is a way of this. That was Bhikkhu Bodhi's word. So it means kind of the highest attainment, nibbana, the ability to let go of anything, essentially, and live freely. not that everything is gone, but that we're not stuck on anything anymore, having gone through all these other things that were good, and yet we let go of them for something that's better. So this is, I think, where the striving with heedfulness becomes relevant, because the heedfulness helps us not get stuck also on something that's genuinely good. Please develop virtue. Please develop concentration. These things are fantastic. And I hope that will result in insights. It must, if they're developed. But just like the Buddha, don't give up until you're sure the mind is completely free. And the Buddha did a lot of good stuff. He did concentration attainments. He went and practiced with the great concentration masters of his time. And he realized, this is great while I'm sitting on the cushion, but my mind isn't free yet. And then he did all kinds of ascetic practices, which probably purified his virtue, maybe more than needed. But he said, this isn't it either. And that was when he realized he needed to, sit down under the Bodhi tree. But he wasn't, he didn't give up, he didn't settle for anything less. So we're sort of, moving into the balance. There is the effort, there is the letting go and the ease, and there's doing both of them so that we continue on the path all the way to the end, persevering all the way to the end. I can say that in my own practice, some of the most powerful things that I realized I had cultivated came through instances of letting go. So, for example, for a long time, I was triggered by the noisy atmosphere at family gatherings that I went to, some family gatherings. Some of my family's quiet, but some of them aren't. And I was triggered by this, even like long before I was a practitioner. I've always been kind of, attracted to quiet. And so it was hard for me to be at these gatherings. And it was stressful, basically. And then when I started practicing, it actually got more stressful because then I really valued the silence and I really wanted that. And so it was challenging. And then at some point, though, I realized at some family gathering that it was not triggering me. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. So, I hadn't been specifically cultivating living with sound or things like that. But I had developed some kind of capacity. Something had clearly developed. Cultivation had happened in me. But I experienced it as a letting go of the unpleasantness of that situation. It was still unpleasant. I mean, it's not like I said, oh, wow, I really like sound. I really like noise now. I'm going to join. I'm going to, make a little bit myself. But I just realized it's not triggering me. And so something had been cultivated, and what happened was that I let go of that suffering associated with that. So this is my understanding of how these balance, is that there is cultivation, but it expresses itself as freedom of things being able to pass through us more easily. And that's part of the ease that comes. So the balance, maybe just to wrap that up a little bit more clearly, I'll mention different ways that we can see balance of cultivation and letting go. One is that you do one or the other at different times of practice, different phases of the path. Sometimes we're cultivating. I know people go through phases where cultivating metta, for example, is really, really important. And that's like way more important than doing mindfulness practice or trying to concentrate the mind. It just needs to be metta. And that's a cultivation. And then there are other times where we've been doing a little too much, like you were talking about, or we've reached a plateau, or we're pushing against a wall, and it's like, and then it's just, just letting go, slow down, open up, move to a different city, see what, see what can happen, let go of something, retire, something. And this is, this is how both the students can be right from that initial story. Is it climbing the mountain or is it rolling down the hill? Well, it's both. It's at different times of our practice, we're going to do different ones. So that's one way to think about this balance. Another could be that we understand that all cultivation is a letting go of something else. Mm-hmm. And this is a little bit more subtle, but for example, to develop metta, we have to let go of ill will and anger. To develop patience, we have to let go of impatience. And most letting go, even letting go where we're not. And then I guess the flip side is that letting go is itself is a cultivation of subtle things like renunciation, like dispassion. So even if all I'm doing is letting go, I don't think I'm developing metta. I'm just letting go of my anger. Well, I'm cultivating renunciation of anger. So there are still heart qualities being cultivated, mental qualities being cultivated. So I don't think that, I think letting go and cultivation are kind of two sides of the same hand, in a sense, in some instances. This is not a universal way of seeing it, but it's possible to see it that way, and that's one way to balance them. And then maybe yet another way to understand the balance is understanding that the only relevant effort is the effort to put the conditions in place that make letting go possible. Because I don't think we do the letting go. My experience is that we don't really do it. It's very hard, right? Think about going to sleep. Just mundane, going to sleep at night. You put all the conditions in place, right? You lie down, you darken the room, you get it quiet, you pull up the covers, you relax. But do you actually... Then you have to let go. You can't actually make yourself go to sleep. You are responsible for creating the conditions. But then something else has to happen, right? Something. Falling asleep, right? And I think it's ironic to liken waking up to falling asleep. But there's something about this path that is... similar to that, in that we put all the conditions in place. We do the effort, we do the right livelihood, we do the virtue, we do the sitting on the cushion, we do the all of that. There's doing, for sure. But I don't think we do the awakening. I think there's a letting go. The letting go has its own agenda. And so effort, so what the summary of that is, effort is necessary but not sufficient. So I think in the end, the balance of effort and letting go is that letting go wins. It's the final, there's going to be a final letting go that doesn't have a corresponding quality to it. Nibbana doesn't have a counterpart, if you will. But along the way, we cultivate and we let go, we cultivate and we let go, and then there's that. We've created the conditions for that letting go to happen. For the mind to awaken and really fully transform the heart.
In the stories of the disciples, there's always the aura of inevitability of the enlightenment because the story is already written. Whereas when you're thinking about your own life and your own path, you want the end to be right now.
Yeah, boy, that's for sure. And it doesn't feel like it's necessarily going to happen, right?
There's no,
the nature of the darkness is that when you're in the darkness, you can only imagine the light. I can't, I'm not enlightened, so I can't guarantee anything. But there are suttas that say, this is what Gil was talking about with the no going uphill, that say once you get on the path, it's like flowing to the ocean. This like the rain falls on the top of the mountain and it gathers into puddles and then it flows down the streams and then it fills the lakes and then those flow and overflow their banks and become great rivers and eventually it's going to get to the ocean. That there's just no other possibility for water from the top of a mountain. And so there is... in the suttas, a pretty clear inevitability to it, which I find very inspiring. It doesn't say it'll happen in this lifetime. So there is that little caveat for those of us in the West who find rebirth challenging. It does not say anywhere that it will happen in this lifetime. But it does say, there's another interesting sutta that says, someone comes to the Buddha and says, is it true that everyone will get free, or is it that three quarters or half? You know, like, what's the percentage here? What are my chances? Yeah, you know that that's what he's saying. Yeah. Really. But the Buddha is very smart about how he answers that one. What he says is, I don't say what fraction it is. What I say is that anyone in the past who got enlightened, anyone in the future who will get enlightened, and anyone now who is getting enlightened, does so by the methods that I teach. That's what he says. So, there you go. The choice is put back to you. Yeah. That's why we have Sangha, by the way, is that to encourage each other, because this is not an easy path. It's not, and we can't see the end of it easily, and, you know, who knows? But I know that along the way, the encouragement that path seems to provide helps get through the next obstacle. Seems to be just enough to get me to the next one. Other comments? Have there been things on your path that you had to abandon or let go? And what did that feel like? Or how do you see the balance of cultivation and letting go?
It's most stark when you're forced to let go of something you didn't realize you were hanging on to.
Oh, yeah.
That there was just something that you assumed about life that wasn't actually
true.
Fixed.
Yeah.
It's true. It was true at the time, and maybe it's no longer true.
I see.
And
you sound like you may have an example of that. You don't need to share specifically, but I hear you. Yeah. And then, like, the whole scene changes, right? It's like, oh, wow, things are different now. Yeah.
And then to be okay with that and to let the original go.
Yeah, that can be hard. Because the new one may or may not be more pleasant than the other one. But we know that one will change too. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're continually asked to do that, to become other people on this path.
You know, for me, I was just trying to think, letting go. I think my path has been one of taking on, and things have dropped off. You know, as I've done things differently, I've thought differently. It was more on the effort side, you know.
You've done effort, yeah.
Right, and rather than,
Well, you said things have dropped off. What does that mean?
The anger, resentment, those things that just kind of
withered.
Yes, and there was no effort to do it. It was just that out of pain or out of wanting things differently, I've done my life differently or concentrated. The effort and the other thing just kind of dropped away.
This is beautiful. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and I didn't intend for that, you know. I mean, I just wanted things differently, and the effort to do things, keep my mouth shut when at certain times, pay more attention, you know, those kind of things have really made the difference.
Yeah,
with me.
Yeah. No, this is fantastic. I mean, it points toward us not really doing the letting go, and yet it happens kind of around the edges sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, there's another sutta that talks about it makes an image. I love images in the suttas. It has the image of a ship where you haul it up during the, you know, the off season, basically, and it gets in the rain and the sun and the wind, the stormy season. You're not sailing it, and then basically the ropes on the ship just decay, you know, through all that. And then when you haul it out in the spring, the ropes just fall apart, and you have to replace them. But the point is, we don't want to replace them. The ropes are analogies for the things that are binding us, the anger and the resentment and the lack of attention. And just through the beating of the sun and the wind, or through the effort to do, to keep our mouth shut or to do things in our life, those things just kind of wither and fade over time. And then at some point they just crumble away and they're not there anymore. And it didn't really take effort. You know, you didn't have to get out the hatchet and cut the ropes. They just decayed over time. And that's how the fetters in our heart can be sometimes, through effort in other areas. It's a beautiful analogy. Thank you, Ginny.
Seems like a small example, but actually just about a week ago, it began to actually hurt to check my cell phone.
Oh.
And I mean, it was grating. It wasn't like I thought, you know, it's bad, you shouldn't check your cell phone so much, you know, for your email. It just actually started to be really irritating.
Oh.
In fact, so irritating that if I thought about the amount of times I checked it before, it would have felt like maybe a saw blade being driven. And it's weird. But it was like that.
Yeah.
I just don't want to do it anymore.
Yeah. So something has fallen away.
But I mean, it wasn't a huge problem. It's not like I started practice, so I'd stop checking my cell phone. It's like I just noticed.
That it's agitating to do that.
It's just really irritating.
Yeah. That can happen. Yeah. It's not a trivial example at all, actually. Okay, any more? That's what I had to share. So, very good. So next week we're going to talk about the balance between on the cushion and in the world, which is an interesting one, especially since it's discussed in the suttas a little bit differently than we talk about it now in the modern world. So that's going to be a sort of a contrast between the written texts and our modern life. But it's a very real one of acting. You know, we can't just sit, but we can't just act in the world. We have to do both. And how do we balance those? So I look forward to seeing you next week. If you come, I'll be here for sure. So. All right. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is great. Thank you.